Well, good morning, everyone. Just to add to a couple things that Diane said, and just so you know, the whole microphone thing, Amanda said that the whole system is kind of wonky today, so I don't know what's going on with all that, but I do know that in one of the offices back in the main office, we have a solution to part of it that has arrived this week. We got some dedicated mic packs and mic stuff that should solve some of the interference that we've been having. And so we'll look to be getting those things installed here in the next couple of weeks, and hopefully that'll resolve most of that issue. To Diane's story about an individual who attended a church, and for 2 years nobody said hi to him. One of the things we've talked about over the course of time is that there's a vast difference between being friendly and being welcoming. Friendly is, hi, how are you? And then move on and go talk to your circle of friends. Welcoming is being willing to put your conversation with your friends, who you're going to go to lunch with, on hold, to go to someone else and say, hi, how are you? How can I help you this morning? And so we've talked a lot about, we want to be friendly, but more than friendly, we want to be welcoming, and we want people to know that we genuinely do care about them and value them, whether they've been here for 147 years like some of you, or just a couple of years and all that. So the other thing is that I will let you know that the message for today, I have literally cut in half. As I prepped it, I thought, wow, this is a lot to cover. And as I reviewed it, I thought, wow, this is a lot to cover. And as I reviewed it more, I thought, wow, this is too much to cover. And so here's what my plan is. And sometimes our best laid plans shift and move and all that. As we have walked through this journey with Paul, there have been some things that we've covered with a real broad brush. One message, we tried to cover like 7 chapters of something, and I could spend the entire message time on one verse. You guys know that because I've done that before. And so in trying to cover 7 chapters, there's things that we gloss over, there's things that we touch with a broad brush, and there's things we don't touch at all. So I'm going to shift some things up from what we have done to this point. And then after that, as we venture deeper into Paul, I think we're going to go just like a chapter at a time. And however long we spend and all that. But I think we're going to when we start with the book of Romans, we're going to start a chapter at a time. And then when we're all done with everything that Paul wrote, I think my plan is that we're going to cycle back to some of the stuff that we've glossed over and hit those types of things, which likely would carry us through the entire year of 2025 and maybe even into 2026. So, that's my plan. We'll see what happens because, well, the old phrase that you find in the biblical narrative is, Lord willing. Lord willing, that's my plan. So, how many of you have ever heard the phrase, different strokes for different folks? How many have ever seen the TV sitcom, different strokes for different folks? So, different strokes for different strokes is a proverbial saying that basically means different people approach different things different ways, and that's okay. That there are people that require a certain approach, and then there are people that require a different approach. And there are people who use one approach with one person and a different approach with a different person. And that's okay. Though the phrase has become common, there's some question about where the phrase originated and who used it first. It's believed that the phrase originated in the United States in the 1960s. And it is believed, it is suggested, that an individual by the name of M. Tunnell used it for the very first time. How many people have ever heard of M. Tunnell? Yeah, me neither. M. Tunnell was a football coach, an assistant coach for the New York Giants football team, and it's believed that he was the first one to use the phrase different strokes for different folks. Or, yeah, that's right. I don't know. I was alive in 1966 when he, well, maybe not. Depends on what. Man, it's going to get hostile. Hey, Larry Tharp, thank you for leaving the tomatoes out there, because so, because it's also suggested that in November of 1966, in which I was alive in November of 1966, that Muhammad Ali, the boxer, first used the phrase. He had an interview with a guy by the name of Cleveland Williams. Nope, me neither. Cleveland Williams, in this interview, asked him a question about his fighting style and his recent knockout punches to Sonny Liston and Floyd Patterson. And in response to Cleveland Williams' question, Muhammad Ali looked back at him and said, "Hey, I got different strokes for different folks." And it's suggested that it was the first time, though it's rarely used anywhere else in the English-speaking language, it became common in the United States. In 1968, Sly Stone included different strokes for different folks in one of his songs. I've never heard of Sly Stone, nor have I think I ever heard a Sly Stone song. The name of it was Everyday People. It was the name of the song. How many of you have heard that song, Sly Stone? Now, see, I was like 2 years old. So, yeah, I probably have heard it, just don't remember. So in 1974, Volkswagen used the phrase different strokes for different people as part of a commercial advertisement. It became so, but because it's a proverbial saying, it means that it is a general truth rather than a universal truth. And so you have to discern when different strokes for different folks applies and when it doesn't. It begs the question when we have to ask what you're talking about and when we don't. If you don't understand the what you're talking about reference, you need to Google the TV sitcom Different Strokes for Different Folks and look at the character Arnold in it, and he says that all the time. So we have to ask this question. About when does different strokes for different folks apply? When is it a general rule and when is it a universal principle? There was misconception and misguidance all through the Corinthian church about this idea of different strokes for different folks. And so Paul had received letters from them asking questions, and he had received reports about what was going on in there, and he learned that there were problems, that there were moral issues in the church and things that needed to be addressed and things that needed to be corrected because the church had taken an inappropriate different strokes for different folks approach to things. And so in this part of his letter, he writes to them to once again identify problems, offer solutions, and point them to what it means not just to be made right with God, but also to live right with God. And here's what he says. He says, "I can hardly believe the report about the sexual immorality going on among you, something that even pagans don't do." Now, Corinth was a typical Greco-Roman city. It was immersed in all sorts of idolatry. It was immersed in all sorts of immorality. There was a verb, I shared this last week, there was a verb in this culture that was, it was called to Corinthianize. And the word or the phrase to Corinthianize meant to practice sexual immorality, because that's how pervasive it was in this culture. He says, "This is something that even pagans don't do." Go ahead. "I am told that a man in your church is living in sin with his stepmother." Now, this type of relationship between a stepson and a stepmom was forbidden in the Jewish law. I mean, now we sit back and go, really? That's something they had to forbid? But if you look at the list of things that are forbidden in like Leviticus chapter 18, it's mind-boggling the things that they had to list as don't do this, because that was the culture that surrounded them. It was also forbidden in the Greco-Roman law. This is one of the behaviors that was universally considered abhorrent in that culture. That you did not have this kind of parent-child relationship between a stepson and a stepmom or stepdad, stepdaughter, that whole kind of deal. So basically the story here is the individual in the church was not even married to his stepmom. They were just living together. And in this culture, the relationship between a stepmom and a stepson would have been considered the same or the equivalent as a mother and son. And so there were lines that you just didn't cross. But this individual was supposedly living with his stepmom. And according to 2 Corinthians 7, it appears that the dad isn't dead. That the dad is still alive. And so what's going on here in this relationship is clearly, clearly problematic. Paul then goes on to say about the church, "You are so proud of yourselves, but you should be mourning in sorrow and shame, and you should remove this man from your fellowship." Paul says they are so proud. They are proud and boasted about how open they were and how tolerant they were and how accepting of people they were, regardless of behaviors. They were so tolerant and had become so accepting that they became indifferent to behaviors that were clearly unacceptable. A practice of life, a lifestyle choice that was clearly abhorrent universally. All religion, they just forbid this type of behavior. But the church in Corinth allowed it and welcomed the individual in as if he was doing nothing wrong. And Paul said, "You are so proud of yourselves for your openness and your tolerance and your acceptance that you're willing to overlook something that is clearly wrong." He said, "You should be mourning in sorrow and shame for the sin that is being committed in your midst without you addressing it." And the phrase that he uses for mourning here is the type of mourning that is done for someone who is deceased. It is perhaps the deepest level of mourning and the deepest level of sorrow and shame that an individual can experience. And Paul says the church in Corinth should be experiencing that level of mourning because of how proud they are over the behavior that they have allowed to infect itself in the life of the church when it should have been addressed because it is clearly immoral and improper and unacceptable. He says, "And you should remove this man from your fellowship." And as if that's not enough, as if just kicking him out of the church isn't enough, Paul goes on to say, "Then you must throw this man out and hand him over to Satan, so that his sinful nature will be destroyed and he himself will be saved on the day the Lord returns." Now, what does it mean to throw him out? So, kick him out of the church and tell him that his behavior doesn't align with clearly what should be, that there has to be a consequence to his behavior, and hand him over to Satan. What does that mean? Because that sounds pretty extreme and pretty harsh. And what this means is not that you don't allow this man to have access to salvation. Because salvation is not the church's to grant. Salvation is God alone to grant. And so the church does not take this man's salvation. It does not mean that you send him to hell or condemn him to hell. What it means is that you kick him out of the church to say, "Your behavior is unacceptable." And here's a little bit of a challenge, and we'll address this in a few minutes. Here's a little bit of the challenge, because when someone's behavior is out of kilter, they need to be in a place where they learn how to get their behavior back in alignment, right? So it seems like kicking him out of the church would be counterproductive to what's going on. But what Paul says here is this is an extreme measure in an extreme case. Instead of openly accepting and tolerating the behavior, you should remove him from the church so that his eyes can be opened and he can suffer the consequences of his sin. And here's the motivation: so that his sinful nature will be destroyed, so that he will recognize that his behavior is not in alignment with the way that it should be, and that he himself will be saved on the day that the Lord returns. So the motivation isn't to take salvation away from him or to condemn him to hell. The motivation is so that his lifestyle, which was compromised, would be changed and uncompromised, and that his salvation, he would wake up to the way that his relationship with God should be in place through Jesus. That's the motivation. So when this church is supposed to enact discipline, which is a word we don't like, on this individual, it is not to condemn him, it is not to judge him, it is to awaken him and make him aware of his relational status with God. It says, your boasting about this is terrible. So they were boasting, they were proud of what was going on. It's almost like they would go around and tell everybody, hey, look, we're such a good church that we let people sleep and live with their stepmothers in sin, even though the dad's still alive. Now, again, you have to wonder sometimes how that even makes sense. He says, your boasting about this is terrible. Don't you realize? And in this section of what Paul writes, he asks a series of don't you realize questions. Some of them are rhetorical because he has already answered the question when he was there prior or answered it in previous letters, or he's already addressed these things with them. He says, don't you realize that this sin is like a little yeast that spreads through the whole batch of dough? So one of the approaches that I take to most things is when I recognize that there's something out of whack, when I recognize that there's, this drives my family crazy, when I recognize that there's a rattle in the car, there's a reason there's a rattle in the car. And guess what my car's not supposed to do? My car's not supposed to rattle. And so when it rattles, there's something wrong. So what I want to do is I want to identify the rattle and get the rattle fixed so that my car doesn't rattle, because if it's a small rattle now, guess what it's going to become later? My whole engine is going to fall out. I want to identify it while it's a small problem. It's like when I bought my truck. I don't remember how many years ago I bought my truck. We bought it in Dayton, Ohio. Went over, picked it up, drove it home. By the time I got home, the gas tank was empty. So I went to the gas station, and I popped the gas lever, and I opened up the gas tank door, and there along the entire gas tank door was a row of rust. Now, who would have ever thought you need to check inside the gas compartment to see if there's rust? Well, guess what happens with rust? When you get rust here, guess what happens? It spreads. You got to stay on top of it, and you may never get it completely, but you got to do your best to keep it gone. So immediately, I took it to a friend of mine who does body work, and he cleaned all that out and fixed it and all that, and I haven't had any more rust in it. There. I have rust over here. So I took it back to him and he fixed that. Because again, I want to identify it when it's a small problem and not let it affect everything. Next thing you know, the whole body's rusted out and you're driving around in the Flintstone car. Don't you realize that this sin is a little yeast that spreads through the whole batch of dough? In other words, if you do not address this now, if you do not address this while it's isolated, then it becomes a bigger problem later, and the entire church will be affected, because that's the way yeast in a whole batch of dough works. And then Paul says, get rid of the old yeast by removing the wicked person from among you. Then you will be like a fresh batch of dough made without yeast, which is what you really are. What Paul writes here connects back to the Jewish Passover feast when the nation of Israel was in Egypt and was leaving Egypt after 400 years of slavery. They did not have time, according to history. They did not have time to add yeast to the dough, which made the dough rise and all that. So they just grabbed the dough and left. And so they began to eat what was called unleavened bread. And when they would go to do the Passover feast, they would go through their homes, because they would celebrate the Passover feast with unleavened bread. They would go through their homes meticulously looking for any type of leaven in the home. And they would remove that leaven from the home so that the bread that they would eat during the Passover feast did not contain any leaven. It was pure dough, without yeast, without anything like that. And so they would go to great lengths to make sure there was no leaven or yeast in the bread. And so it was a pure and unadulterated dough without yeast. And Paul says, get rid of the old yeast, what will permeate the entire batch. Get rid of that by removing the wicked person from among you. Then you will be like a fresh batch, which is what you really are, having been made right with God because of what Jesus did for you. And then he says, Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed for us. But before leaving Egypt, the last of the plagues that God put on Egypt for refusing the Israelites' freedom was what generated the Passover lamb, or the Passover feast and the Passover celebration. The plague, it was called the plague of the firstborn, and God said that the firstborn of every household in the land of Egypt would die on a given night. And he instructed the Israelites to take a lamb, a pure and unblemished lamb, and to sacrifice that lamb, and to take the blood of that lamb and paint it over the doorposts. And so when the angel of death passed through, or passed over, the nation of Egypt and claimed the firstborn of every household, if the angel of death saw a home with the door painted with the sacrificial blood of a lamb, the angel would pass over and the firstborn in that would be spared. And so Paul says to the church in Corinth and to people like us, Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed, unblemished, unadulterated, pure. And so when Jesus bought our salvation, when Jesus bought our redemption from sin, he also bought uncompromised lifestyles. And the individual in the church was compromising his lifestyle, compromising his convictions, resulting in the compromised convictions of the entire church. And Paul reminds them that Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. He says, so let us celebrate the festival, not with the old bread of wickedness and evil, much of which the church in Corinth people would have been accustomed to. They would have been experiencing the tension between the lifestyle of the Greco-Roman culture in which they had immersed themselves and lived in, until Paul came and told them about the good news of Jesus. And the tension between that lifestyle and the lifestyle that now aligns with Christ the Passover Lamb sacrificed for you, who bought an uncompromising lifestyle at the same time. There was a tension between that. And Paul says, let's celebrate the festival. Let's celebrate the Passover festival, not with the old bread of wickedness and evil, but with the new bread of sincerity and truth. And the word that's used for sincerity there means that when something is placed under and examined under the sun's light, it is found to be pure and unblemished. And he says, let's celebrate with the new bread of that which is pure and unblemished. And we celebrate the Passover. We celebrate the very thing that the nation of Israel did but in a different way, because our Passover lamb is Jesus. He says, when I wrote to you before, I told you not to associate with people who indulge in sexual sin. When he had written to him before, whether it was in response to a letter or a visit or a report, he had told them not to associate with people who indulge in sexual sin. Now, there's a tension there, because we are supposed to associate with people to help them understand what following Jesus means. And now Paul's telling you not to associate with those people. That's not what he means. What he means here is the word associate is probably better translated keep company. And when we keep company, we are making an intentional choice to continually spend time with someone. And Paul says, don't keep company with people like this. It's kind of like we told our kids when they were growing up and they encountered people who weren't necessarily the best influence. We're like, you know, you don't have to be rude to them and treat them as an outcast or anything like that, but you also don't have to choose to hang out with them all the time. You can separate yourself without being rude and still be cordial and all that when you come across them. He says, but I wasn't talking about unbelievers who indulge in sexual sin or are greedy or cheat people or worship idols. You would have to leave the world to avoid people like that. So, in other words, though we are separate, we still live in the same world, a world that has people that have issues. And he said, I'm not talking about them. It is okay to associate with them. You would have to leave the world to avoid people like that. And that's probably not going to happen. And so what we need to do is we need to figure out how to live in that world while maintaining uncompromised lifestyles. And then he goes on to say, I meant that you are not to associate with anyone who claims to be a believer, yet indulges in sexual sin, or is greedy, or worship idols, or is abusive, or is a drunkard, or cheats people. Don't even eat with such people. It seems like there's a double standard going on here. It's okay to associate with people who do this, as long as they don't claim to be a believer. But if somebody claims to be a believer and they do that, I'm not supposed to associate with them. The point that Paul is making here is that we should not expect followers of Jesus. Hold on. We should not expect people who are not followers of Jesus to act like followers of Jesus. And we should not hold them to the standard of following Jesus when they don't follow Jesus. On the other side of that coin, if someone has claimed to be a follower of Jesus, we should expect them to act and behave like a follower of Jesus. And we should hold them accountable to the standard of following Jesus. We have no grounds or jurisdiction to hold a person who is not a follower of Jesus to the standard of following Jesus because they have not chosen to follow Jesus. We should expect them to live a lifestyle that does not match what following Jesus looks like. But when someone has made the decision to follow Jesus, we have every grounds and every jurisdiction to hold them accountable to a lifestyle that aligns with following Jesus. He goes, it isn't my responsibility to judge outsiders. It is God's responsibility to judge outsiders. But it is certainly your responsibility to judge those inside the church who are sinning. Paul basically says, we do not have a right to hold accountable people outside the church for their behavior that doesn't align, but we certainly do have a responsibility to hold accountable those inside the church. It says, God will judge those on the outside, but as the scriptures say, you must remove the evil person from among you. It is God's to judge those on the outside. It is ours to hold accountable those on the inside. You must remove the evil person from among you, which seems harsh, which seems difficult, but if you go back to what Paul had written earlier, it was so that the sinful nature would be destroyed and the person would be saved on the day that the Lord returns. Different strokes for different folks is applicable about certain things. It is a general rule in some things, and it is universal elsewhere. But when we apply different strokes for different folks, as the Corinthians did, and turn it into an everything is permissible approach, it will lead to compromised convictions, and compromised lifestyles, and a compromised church. Well, Paul had asked a series of don't you realize questions. And so I think it's appropriate to wrap up today with a don't you realize question. Don't you realize that when Jesus bought your redemption from sin, he also bought an uncompromised lifestyle? It is one thing to be made right with God, and another thing to live right with God. As followers of Jesus, we are called to lead uncompromised lifestyles based on uncompromised convictions, through uncompromised faith in an uncompromised Savior. Let me pray for us this morning, and then we'll roll the preview video for next week. Hey, and just so you know, that was half. And after the preview video, you'll be dismissed. Dear God, thank you for today. Thank you for this incredibly powerful part of Paul's letter, through which we learn that different strokes for different folks doesn't apply to the lifestyles that we lead. Though there is room for differences, and there is room for openness and tolerance and grace and patience and forgiveness and love and mercy and compassion. There's room for all of that. But we cannot move so far in the different strokes for different folks that everything becomes permissible and the church and our lifestyles as followers of Jesus become compromised. God, help each of us to identify the areas in our lives where we've put our guards down and we've not guarded our hearts and our lives. And in the event that there's a need to hold someone accountable, help us to do it wisely, confidently, boldly, but also with the same type of mercy, compassion, grace, and love that you extended to me in the midst of the uncompromised choices that I make. Pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.